This interview is being conducted for Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium Sewer Upgrades in Fort Yukon, Alaska, 2012. The interviewer is Sarah Corbin. Richard Carroll is being interviewed in Fort Yukon on November 16, 2012.
I was born in the mouth of the Shinjuk River, 1930. I've been in Fort Yukon area, and that's only out of town here. I've been in Fort Yukon ever since. I schooled, married. Dad had we started a trading post in 1927. He built this building that don't exist anymore. It was a new venture for him. He went broke in 2 years. He gave everything away on prospective trappers who were supposed to go out trapping and repay him, but it didn't quite work out that way. So he himself went out trapping for a couple more years and made enough money to reopen his store. Meantime, he got a contract with a furrier in Juneau, Goldstein and Company, and bought furs for them. And this added income put him back in the business again. A small business. I don't think my dad did more than, I'd say, $100,000 a year in total trading. I know that don't sound like much today, but back in those days, that was a lot of trading. He traded until, I believe, 62, 61, and Dad got too old that he couldn't do anything, and closed the business out and spent the rest of his years in the easy chair. Myself, I started a small trading post, very small. My intentions, and had it all planned out in paper, that if I made if I sold $100,000 worth of merchandise 1 year, I'd make a very good living. I sold $100,000 in 3 months, and it just got too much for me. I couldn't handle it myself, and I couldn't afford to hire anybody at that time with no knowledge of trading in the trading business. So I got rid of it. We also bought furs. It went right along with the trading. A person would come in and throw a fox across the counter and says, give it to me all in trade. The reason he says that, he knows he can get a few extra bucks in trade price than he could in the cash price. This is always the thing you do. But I couldn't handle it. My kids were a little too small on one side and too old and smart on the other side, so I had to close it. That ended my stint in the trading business.
What years did you have your trading post open?
Oh, boy. Are you there, Eva?
1970.
In the 70s, huh?
Yeah, into 80s.
Yeah, I was going to say late 70s and up through 80s.
Do you remember the sort of goods that your dad sold at his trading post?
He sold general merchandise that you see in the store shelves today. We didn't see a lot of fancy stuff like cookies and snack items. You didn't see none of that. It was basic material and a lot of tobacco. Everybody smoked. He put up an outfit 1 year for a trapper, and he had down 120 cartons of cigarettes. And my dad was shocked. That's 2 cases of cigarettes. 60 cartons to a case. So he called the gentleman over to the site, and he says, "You sure you want that many cigarettes?" "Yeah," he says, "I think that'll take me through till spring." Dad says, "You want to charge us all the smokes up to?" Then it wasn't very expensive, but it was then. I think a cigarette was 2.5 a carton or something like that, $3. Yeah. One thing you had in the stores in those days, my dad's trading days, that you don't see in the store today, is yard goodage. There was a lot of canvas, different weight and width, and a lot of women's sewing material, such as calico. Many bundles of calico they had, and they also sold moose hide. That was an in-trade item. People in Arctic Village would tan moose hides and stuff, and caribou hides, and then he'd buy it from them and then retail it back out to local people that don't do that type of work. So outside of those bulk items, the shelves are about the same.
Was there anything that people didn't sell here in Fort Yukon that had to be ordered by catalog or or brought in otherwise?
Well, household merchandise, they didn't sell furniture. They didn't sell cook stoves or anything like that. Individually, they ordered through Sears and it would come up on the barge. Otherwise, everything else was available. And at just about the time, you know, the barge service was getting out of business and the airlines were flying in here. So the planes are big enough, you can order a couch or overstuffed chair and stuff from Fairbanks. And it would come here 2-3 days instead of like Cirrus around with the barge line. It'll take 6 weeks.
Where did your dad order the goods for his store from?
He had several brokerage houses in Seattle area. Seattle Hardware Company was the biggest, I believe, that he ordered from Schwabecker Hardware. Those are the two that I remember. And most of the traders in this area, interior, all ordered from the same place.
There were several stores here at the same time. Did they all have about the same price for their goods?
Yeah, let's see. We had Alaska Commercial, which is the biggest and the oldest established store here, which is your AC company today. H.E. Carter. Carter's had a store, a very large store. My dad had a store. The gentleman up the road had a store for many years. He's a trapper, trader, Fred E.D. Mars. And prices vary a little bit. AC company priced were stationary. The others could move their prices up and down according to season or maybe stock or so forth. You know, oranges were 25 cents each, $1 a dozen. Bananas, apples, until the end of the barge season, you didn't get any more than. Eggs was pretty reasonable. I think they were 70 cents a dozen. But they had a lot of different kind of canned meats. I was noticing a while back, I was looking through an ordering form a long time ago. And they had, you know, they had canned beef heart, canned beef kidney, canned beef liver, which they don't have today. They make other products with them, I guess, but you don't have, can't buy any more corned beef and liver either. Corned beef and cabbage, had canned cabbage, canned wieners, and that's about a few things I've noticed that they don't manufacture anymore.
Do you still have those order forms?
Oh, we probably do somewhere. You can see my place is in an upset mess here, so I wouldn't be able to locate them for quite some time.
Do you remember Ivor Peterson's store?
Yes, Ivor came in. I'm sorry, I didn't mention his name. He came in later on, sort of the last of the trading group. He had a store right across the street from us here. He's a trapper. He's more interested in trapping, and he got himself a bulldozer, and between that toy and his trapping, he ran quite a store. He opened in the evening, and he had a lot of merchandise that other people didn't have either, and his prices were different. His prices were pretty low. And that's
what sort of merchandise did he have that others didn't have?
Same merchandise, but his store, it's without interest. Going to a store, because you don't know, you have to ask for something. You have to ask for pork and beans, because he had many square shelf space, but it's never on the shelf. So he'd reach behind the counter and throw a few paper boxes around and reach down and bring up someone all the cans he wanted. He knew where they were, you know. And he was never organized, and I think a lot of people went to just watch him trade. It was kind of interesting. Tell you what, a trader he was, like a bookkeeper. It's a good hangout in the evening time. People go in the store and sit on benches inside where the customer should have used the space, but everybody else used it. He would get off subject here. Well, anyway, it was a good gathering place also in the evening for people. They tell stories, and trappers always got a tale to tell, you know. They always try to outdo the other guy. They sit around and do this, and kids coming in buying candy bars and stuff. But he left here, went outside. I understand that he took quite a few books with him, and hundreds of thousands with him that he made here.
What sort of people would hang out and listen to Ivor's stories or talk?
Local people. I'd go over there in the evening, or a lot of people would just hang out. Ivor was always interesting. He never told the same story twice, same way. He'd tell it one way, and the next evening, he'd say, repeat the story, but he'd put a little more twist to it. And you know, it just wasn't quite 100% true. He's telling you. As I mentioned earlier, a lot of local people hung out in the stores in the evenings. I know my dad's store, you know, most of the old people are getting too old to go out trapping anymore, so they all stay home. They get a little $50, $60 a month pension from the state and listen to the radio and chew tobacco. And my dad always had one half of his store was sort of woman's wares. And he had, like I said, calico and stuff like that. But the women were always afraid to come into his store because all these old-timers were out in front or would occupy his trade area inside. He finally blew up one day and told them all, get the hell out. You come over and sit over here or bring your own chair, so I'm going to be driving my business away. Well, they moved from the left counter to the right counter. Still hung around. You see, they left their home. My dad opened at 9 o'clock, and there were three or four of them at the door waiting for help and turn the key to get in. And they'd stay there all day until 5 or 6 o'clock whenever he closed, because they didn't have to go home. They didn't have to add any more wood to their fire or do anything. And it's a real hangout for the old people. And these ladies come into the store, didn't want to buy any undies. These old timers gawking at them, you know. So it's always laughable.
Did every family in Fort Yukon in those days trap, or how did people make their money to buy things at the stores?
Fort Yukon was strictly, at one time, one of the largest trading centers in Alaska and raw furs. Up until, 40. I'd say up to about 40, right at the end of the war, 44, 45. See, they'd get an outfit. I want to go out trapping. I'd go and ask my dad for an outfit. His outfit would run from $600 to $1,200, which is a big outfit. Average about $600, $700. And you went out, got your furs, and brought them in at Christmas time, and did your annual celebrating, and head back out again, come back in June. There was no cash, there was no jobs, and it was strictly, you either get out and trap, do something, or you don't exist. I ask myself that question sometimes. I know some people don't trap. I heard it. But I guess they live off one another. But it's everybody trap. So the smaller kids, 5, 6 year old, are out there with their little number of trap looking for weasel holes or something, you know. They want to make a dollar or two. And they finally starting to understand the almighty silver dollar is the best thing there is around. And a lot of them quit trapping and moved to Fairbanks to get a government job. And they were working at Ladfield out of Fairbanks. And left on a map, it left big splotches open that the people have left. Oh, something else is moving and do a little trapping. But the trapping industry had a big F in front of it because it cost too much to go out, and fur prices weren't good. You know, and foxes one time were selling for $700-$800 each. Today they got 50 cents each. So man ain't gonna go out in the woods on that. He go look for work. And those that found work saw them permanently quit trapping. And they permanently left work gone. And they moved to the city, moved to Fairbanks. But those that stayed, continued trapping, had a better increase in the price of in their catches because the area didn't have as many trappers, and they had more access to the furs. So it sort of balanced out.
What years were the fur prices high, and what years were they low?
Oh, you see, at the beginning of World War II. Like I said, a lot of people have left here and went to work for the government. A lot of them got drafted. I think that at least 40, 50 young men got drafted in Fort Yukon, went to the war. Nobody was trapping. And it left those animals out there breeding up. After the war was over, people had money. They worked all during the war and they'd buy anything. And ladies liked to buy a fur coat or choker or something. And that propped the fur price right on up. Martin was selling for $6, $7. By that time, it went up to $60 and $70 each. So this great increase in prices has really started the trapping line back again. They all trapped, and it bottom dropped out again, and it varied. Cold War started, and that scared everybody. The big furrier companies that bought fur, they backed off. It varied about every 4 or 5 years, the price would go up and go back down, depending on the world situation. And it's hard to believe. Russia started to get in the fur business, and Russia started flooding the United States market with their furs. So our Alaska wolf, a big white wolf, would settle for $150 to $250, and they flooded the market over here with Russia wolf, which was a little skinny animal, and they could sell them for $50, $60. Well, what are you going to put on your roof? This $50 wolf or this $200 one? Is it? So they fluctuate all the time. Last year, per a year ago today, which is 10, I guess, beginning of 10 to 11, fur prices was no good. Nobody wanted to go trapping. Something happened. It spurred the fur price to go up, and I think it started in Canada. And they had an outlet over in the European market. Martin jumped up from $10-$15 top United States price to $130-$140 European price. So everybody goes after the Martin and sell it through an outlet to the European market. Just yesterday, we were checking the price of Martin this fall. Martin in the United States top price was about $30. You look at it today, you see $135-$140. It's through the European market again. So it fluctuates different. And they're, what they're doing is they're selling it to these little foreign countries. You know, we support most of those little foreign countries. I say we, the United States. They in turn buy merchandise such as our furs, quadruple the price of the local market has. It sort of ring around the rosy, you know. Give that old country the millions they want, because we know next year our fur price is going to be high.
Do you think your dad did better as a fur trapper or a fur buyer?
My dad was an excellent fur trapper. He was also an excellent fur buyer. He understood furs. And being a trapper really helps you if you're going to go in the fur buying business. He can pick up a skin and tell you exactly what area it got caught in due to the type of the furs, especially Martin. You know, Martin likes to be in a place where there's a lot of berries and a lot of feed, and their fur is good. Lynx, they've got to have a lot of food too with them, and you've got to understand the fur business pretty well to get in there and buy your top prices, don't buy the other stuff. He knew his furs.
Do you recall if any of the stores in town sold sort of exotic foods or things like canned foods from Europe?
Well, no, they all, nothing exotic. No. They sold like all the others. It's got sold by from the same place. No special salesman comes through here.
And you had mentioned that your dad would purchase tanned moose hides and caribou hides from Arctic Village. Were there other items made either here in Fort Yukon or in the surrounding villages that he sold at his store?
Locally, he bought snow boots. We call canvas boots. It's a moose hide bottom, canvas topping. The warmest thing you could wear, no matter what anybody tells you. And mittens, moose hide mittens, fur mittens. Fur caps. These items are still being sold, made and sold today, but not too much to the trading out. But my daughter runs a shop back in the airport that she sells homemade items, such as I mentioned. And one item I have noticed myself, I never discussed it with my wife, but you don't see many dancing slippers anymore like you used to. They're all beaded dancing slippers with trimmed in ermine, and the floor used to be full of them. No, I don't think they think about looking down at their feet. I think they just wear their leather shoes and put it. Yeah.
Would dancing slippers have been something that people would buy at a store trading post, or would they make those for themselves?
Most of them make them for themselves. I say it was sort of a competition between the ladies who made the prettiest and matching the beads and stuff. But you can order them. You can purchase them. I don't see this anymore.
How about dried meats or fish locally? Did any of the stores sell that?
They sold that back in the 1900s. My dad dealt in fish, not in meat. I think all the stores dealt in the fish, but no meat. You can get it when you order privately, but yeah, they got some people put salmon bellies, king salmon bellies, and brine, sell them in little 20-gallon barrels, and smoked, half-dried. They prepared that for all the many ways, and they still do it today.
Were there the roadhouses that were here? Would they purchase all of their food from the stores, or did they hunt for themselves?
No, let's see. We had two main roadhouses here in town. The Fort Recon Hotel and the big house, we call. No, they would, I think they'd probably go out and do their own hunting for moose and caribou. At that time, they can serve it to the public. Today, you can't. Everything is sort of semi-controlled by the government, that even King Salmon, you have to have a permit. So it's, and they're getting more scarce on the river. Most of them would buy their beef in quarters and have it brought in. They cut it themselves.
Did your dad's store, do you recall other stores bringing in much beef, pork, chicken?
No, they're all about the same. Since there's no like a butcher shop, years ago, that they had a saw in the back and they cut everything up. Here's a good prepackaged. You buy one steak wrapped, or hamburger comes in pound packs now, and wieners come in pound packages. The packing industry has changed completely.
Did they bring in like a large side of beef and then cut it up for people?
Yes. My mother used to tell us stories about when she was a little girl. She could stand down in the riverbank here and watch six steamboats going up the Yukon, plying the river, all loaded with beef or cows or whatever you want to call them, cattle and other four-footed animals, on the way up to the gold fields to Dawson. You see, they take them, bring them down St. Michael and put them on the river boats, and the barges take them all the way up to Dawson and Whitehorse. There they kill them and do their distribution up there. Because they had no refrigeration units, so they had to ship beef in on the hoof.
Did they do that in here in Fort Yukon ever, or were the animals already killed by the time they got here?
I have never been told that they killed any animals here because there wasn't the demand for it. Now, you can order a cow and or beef, and it'll get off the barge here, and you take it home and kill it yourself, but not in large quantities like up in the Dawson field. In the gold fields.
Did there used to be horses in Fort Yukon?
Yes, there were many horses in Fort Yukon. They were the only workers they had here. Many local people, my dad had six of them. He's still wondering what he got them for. But they do minor work around and haul wood with them, and mainly bringing logs out. And there's no track equipment like you have today, bulldozer or something. So they had do it by manual, it's saying is. Yeah, when the Canalaska border was put in, they brought 300 horses through here, the survey team. And that's what they use as their mode of transportation, cutting the trail on one side of the United States to the other, in Canada to the other, make the marker line out. Story is that they lost a bunch of them, and they ran wild here for a while, and I guess a couple of guys went out, got themselves some easy moose meat, knew something was wrong. they finally got somebody in, don't know what kind of animal they got. And you killed a horse, you didn't kill a moose.
Where did people get the food for their horses?
Everything is barged in.
Everything barged in?
Yeah. Yeah. Your main river barge line came through St. Michael. From St. Michael, it was transferred to similar barges, or maybe left on those barges. And if a lot of water is on the Yukon, they leave them on the same barge and push the barge up the river with stern wheelers.
Do you remember the names of any of the barge lines?
Barge lines. Well, there's a Northern Alaska. I understand it was owned by the NC Company. That's the only one I know, the only one we ever dealt with here. Of course, so was later on, the White Pass and Yukon Route became the last of the line, I think.
I heard that Ivar Peterson used to take his truck on a barge to Circle and then drive down to Valdez and pick up the groceries and supplies for his store. Did anybody else do that?
Nope. He did it several times. I mean, that's his method. He didn't have to, and he did it alone. He didn't have to hire anybody else. He's very fortunate. He's never had an accident or been involved in one. Yeah. This building that sits catty-corner to us across here is the second story to the old McQuestion building in Circle. The McQuestion building is the McQuestion brothers that were great traders and operators for the early day gold seekers. It was sat in Circle many years, and when the Alaska Commercial sold out of Circle, Ivar Peterson bought them out. And they had stores and a few buildings and stuff. And he didn't see any use of it there, so Ivar dismantled that building. It hewed logs and put it on his boat, barged it down here along, brought it back up. No one else would do that, you know.
So his store was actually the second story of the McQuestion building?
Yeah, the McQuestion building, the second stop, the top story. It still had part of the gable roof on it, the original gable roof, but I think maybe his kids tore that apart.
He didn't bring the first story of the building, the bottom?
No, it was, he used the logs and the timber for something else and didn't build a store with it. He built another house with it.
Could that be the house that Ruth Peterson and the kids lived in?
Very easily could it be the same building. I think the same structure. You know, he had no need for a two-story building, so he made two houses out of it and put a gable roof on it. It served his purpose.
Can you tell me more about Fred DeMar's store?
Fred E. DeMar's. It's a Frenchman. He was a trapper. He trapped between here and Circle. And he said he's going to go in the trading business, and he built himself a big building. The building still exists in its original form. Someone is living it to this very day. He never went back trapping again. He's getting old. But when the steamboat comes up here, like the steamer Yukon and so forth, they come up the river and they stop down at the AC store, unload their merchandise, and they keep moving it up to Harry Carter's store. Unload his merchandise and keep moving up to my dad's store, unload, and they'd go up the slough here. And Freddie Morris built a special ramp for them to make it easy to unload. That was the last off, and then they turn around and come back.
And that building that was his store is where Paul Herbert lives now?
That's right, yeah.
And Freddie built that building?
Freddie Morris built that building. Well, that building's got huge logs in it, yeah.
Did Freddie sell similar things to everybody else?
Everybody, yep.
How did so many stores
exist
at once? How could the economy support that many stores?
You wouldn't believe me, but I'm going to tell you that there wasn't a cash dollar in this community. It was strictly trading, bartering. Trapping was good. Everybody, average trapper always had money. He always had a dollar or two in his pocket. Not only that, there was, you know, a couple of roadhouses here that served meals. It's a question I can never find a good answer to. It's been asked many, many times. On a Monday morning, at this time, you go uptown and the first 10 people you meet, I bet, don't have a dollar in their pocket. Yet 30, 40 years ago, they would. I don't know what the answer is. It's something held back or something. I don't know.
It's interesting, isn't it?
Oh, yes. Yeah, I always like to know why. Of course, there are a lot of evil means out there to take your money today. But all these trading posts, they all made money. They're all doing good.
Even if they were dealing with trading and bartering with the people who lived in Fort Yukon and the trappers, folks who were running a store, they had to purchase the items with cash.
That's true.
So they must have gotten their cash from the fur buyers. Is that right?
That's how it works.
How it works?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
That's exactly how it works. Yeah. If I had a trader in town here, a Carter's, a big trader, had a huge family here. He didn't have enough money to buy his own outfit one year. He had all his money tied up in roughers that he paid average for foxes. Foxes were probably going for about $2 each then. And he was paying out $25, $30 for them. Well, you either better have a pretty good backer or some cash reserve somewhere, or you're going to have to go out of business. So what they did, they manufactured their own money, bingles, trade tokens. And this has held things together till they went back out trapping again and brought in some more furs, and the fur buyer got some more cash, and it all works out. But it come pretty close to a complete failure one time.
About when would that have been that people were using the bingles or the tokens?
Well, my dad gathered all his up, bought them all in town here. 1938. Took them all out in the middle of the river and dumped them. And the roadhouses all did the same. The only person that hung on to their bingles here was Carter. And he was so deeply in, he had to have some artificial money somewhere to hold him over. But a fur trader didn't want to lose his customer. Now, Carter didn't have any money, and one of the good customers comes and says, I want $100 today. He says, oh, I got no money. You know, that's kind of, it does happen, but, you know, it's kind of goofy. He's a big trader, and he has no money. But I've got $100 bingo. They can trade that. Well, they do.
It was the trapper who set the price for the furs?
No, trader? No. Neither. The trader to a certain extent, but the fur house is outside. See, they have to wait till they get a telegraph message or something from their fur house. Silver foxes are no higher than $10. Mink, large, top price, $6, stuff like this, and they send it in to them. So they kept on top of the prices at that. That way. They always had a telegraph office there, just like your stock market, but basically the same thing.
Would trappers usually deal with the same store or buyer, or did
yes.
they go around
no.
looking for the best price?
When they get their furs in, if you dealt with Carter and he treated you good, you tell him to take the furs. Just give me credit for it, that's it. If you're a wild card out here on your own, and you can go to different prices. You can go to different traders and get a bid on their fur, which a lot of the white folks do. They get bids and they get a few bucks extra. Because you know very well that the local trader ain't going to give you what the fur should really be.
Would you say that Ivar Peterson was more of a trapper or more of a trader?
No, he's a trapper trade. Yeah, trader is second. But he was a hell of a trader.
What did people used to do with their trash in the 1940s and 50s, 60s?
Well, we used to dump all ours in the river. It goes down to the ice, floating by to the next village, I guess. And that keeps accumulating down. That's what happens to it. It wasn't until in the 50s, that changed awful fast. And they brought sanitation programs in, and you handle your trash in a different manner.
I heard that the trappers used to use strychnine.
Strychnine?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yes.
When were they using that?
Well, I used strychnine when I was trapping. Never did me any good. It scared the hell out of me half the time, but...
Did it come in a powder or a liquid?
It's a powder form. It comes in the size of a aspirin bottle, say a 12 pack aspirin bottle. Well, it's what an ounce that comes in there. If it's all worked out right, you should get at least a dozen or more wolves with the contents of that bottle. If you go out, like a certain trapper did here, a white trapper, his name is Linksweiler, he trapped up the Shinjek River, and he got, someone gave him a his and goes poison trapping. He go up and he'd shoot everything that was in his, that was walking as he took his family up to winter out. And he went up and slit the moose or caribou or fox or whatever it is, and he'd lace it with a strychnine. And I think something happened. He poisoned his whole dog team or something. I don't know what happened here, but he lost his complete dog team. Apparently they got sniff around or licking around and got to a strychnine supply and they all died. So he hired my dad to take him up to Shinjek and come up in the springtime, pick him up with a boat. His family's up there. And my dad tells about every, you could tell where every poison set was, because there was hundreds of little animals, birds, all dead in a pile, or strung out on the bar or something. Going another 4 or 5 miles, same thing happened. He'd have a couple of moose out there, step a strychnine in them. And his idea was that the animal would die and he'd go pick it up and skin it. That's fine if you only got one animal. Every animal is a predator to another animal. Wolves would eat one another. Lynx would eat wolves. Well, in the end, he didn't have many. I think my dad said he had about 23, 24 wolves. And he poisoned the whole country, killed everything. There wasn't a whiskey jack around or anything. In the Indian village, which Zai James family and them worked out of from Arctic Village, and they go across the Indian village at on the Shinjek, it's very close if you look at a map. They gave up. They turned around, got the hell out of there. They were scared to drive their dogs any further, afraid that they'd get a gulp of poison. So they moved completely out of there, and they moved back to Arctic Village. They must have stayed away 10 years. And they went back with snow goose. I can't take dogs in there. Eventually, it cured. I shouldn't use the word cure, but eventually it dried up. The strychnine. The only thing that kills strychnine, that dissolves it and dilutes it back to neutral, is water. And a lot of people don't know this. And they try burying it, and making fire, and burn it, and everything else. The strychnine is diluted by water to zero again. So, ain't much fur left there. A few people are back in there now, trapping. They said get a few wolves and wolverine. But this man had no conception of what the hell he was doing. He should have been turned in and ran out of the country. How one man can do so much damage. But as long as he could buy, you could buy strychnine that time in the drugstore. And poison everything off.
So you could buy that in Fort Yukon?
No. Yeah, Fairbanks.
In the drugstore in Fairbanks.
I imagine if you walked in there today and asked for a couple ounces of strychnine, they'd run you out. Yeah, but my dad bought it here. Yeah.
Did many of the traders here sell drugs much beyond aspirin or medicines beyond?
Yeah, they sold toothache medicines. They sold medicine for sore feet and basic, medicines. They didn't sell any drugs as we know them. If they did sell some, they weren't known as drugs then anyway. So they're made up of other chemicals, other medicine. And if you needed something strong, the hospital was very good here. They'd fix you up with a little medicine box and for certain things. You'd like go out and cramps in the legs and or something. Most of the pretty world sort of had to know a little about simple medicine because you're out there in the woods and nobody's there to help you.
Now, you said that most of the town ran on trade and barter and there wasn't money. When do you think that people started using money more than trading and bartering?
The 40s, yeah. That's when money became visible. You know, the stores wouldn't take nickels and dimes here for many years. My dad used to be a bad one for that. They'd come in with 25 cents worth of nickels and dimes and one candy bar. And he'd get the candy bar and when they leave, he'd grab the money and throw it in the furnace. Try to get rid of it. I found out at the end he had to use it, call it nuisance money. Yeah, in the 40s, things kept gaining. More jobs became available in the community. Yeah.
I heard about a store that was Eunice Carney's Cabin, and it was a woman's merchandise store.
Eunice, she had a little woman's clothing store, and she did nice businesses, introduced a lot of new things, and hell, before her, there was another old lady who come up on the barge every year. Well, there's two of them, Mrs. Curtis, old Curtis's wife, and the other one was Mrs. Norwood. She must have been, I figured her, at least 90, and she'd bring her foot locker every year, come up all the way from Seattle, and she had this foot locker so packed with woman's perfume, powders, and so forth, and she'd sell every bit of it here. Go back out and come back next year again. You and I, she had a small store, about maybe 10 by 12 or something, very small. Just putting it adjacent down to her living room. And she sold quite a few little items like hats and clothing.
Where was Eunice's store at?
It was right out here next to their home. It really was a sort of a porch add-on to the outside of their home. Very small, like I say. I think she'd get two customers in there, and that's about it. But she had stuff on display, you know.
And when was her store open?
Oh,
what years about?
When do you think Eunice nicely opened her store?
During the 40s.
Yeah, it had to be during the 40s.
45.
And how about Mrs. Curtis and Mrs. Norwood? Were they coming up on the barge in the 1940s?
Every year.
Did the traders here in Fort Yukon, the men who had the stores, did they sell women's wares and perfume and lotions and things?
Yeah, they did. You used that word a while ago, exotic. It wasn't the exotic stuff that these ladies would have, you know. Perfume would knock you out. Yeah.
And had you ever heard Ivor Peterson's store called the Arctic Circle Store?
No. He had a sign in front of his store, which was a part of the old original Arctic Circle steamboat marker that used to be down 17 miles up the river. He had it out in front there. Maybe that's what they meant. Yeah. Today there's a hell of an opening here in town for a store, strictly a grocery store. And I haven't bought any, but I understand bread is $9 a loaf uptown. I hate to ask the price of milk. And eggs is, how much were eggs the other day we was going to buy some?
$6, I think.
$6 a dozen for eggs? No, thank you. But at least lots of commercial is pushing its luck. Because anyone can come in with a small store and give them competition. First of all, they don't need the 8 or 9 clerks that they have there in the store, nor as big a space as they have.
When it was the Northern Commercial Company, the first one down here on the river, it burnt down, was that 47?
47.
The first one burnt?
Yeah.
And when they rebuilt, did they rebuild in the same spot?
No, they didn't rebuild. 47, you must have seen this Freddie DeMarbling where he said Snooks is in.
Yep.
Okay, they moved to there. They used that for at least 2-3 years. Then where'd they go?
They moved into Carter's.
Oh, by that time Carter's sold out. They bought Carter's out. Yeah, that's the big building downtown, and I think that's destroyed now. Then from there, they moved up to the new store of the building, huh? So Carter got out of the picture at that time. He got.
Did they buy out Freddie DeMare when they took over his building, or had he already quit trading?
Yeah, he already quit trading.
Did you grow up on the trap line as a family? Did you guys all go trapping with your dad?
My age, when I grew up, I was but the last of that breed. Things have changed. Yeah. There was quite a medical history here. I was a medical. I had problems when I was a baby, and my mother just lost a baby brother, I think, of mine. Died in trapper, and she says no more. When I got sick in the line, we were going to town. So I wound up back in town, and the family did, and dad trapped by himself, last of the family. It was good while it lasted, there are all some other complications, a whole bunch of children. Eight or nine of us then. And other families were doing the same things, leave the family in town. And then they could also go to school. You know.
What school did you go to?
The territorial school. Our schoolhouse at that time burned down too. It was sit right where the utility company sits. A huge two-story log building. Now, Fort Yukon was very segregated in their schools. Don't go say that to the editor of the Daily News Miner, he'd throw you out. But we had two school systems here. We had the Bureau of Indian Affairs for Indian children, and we had the territorial school for the white children. This is how it was classified. I wrote an article a while back, many, many years ago, about segregation in a school in Fort Yukon. And I can't think of the guy that the editor now was a Daily News Miner. He says, there's no such thing. Never was. Well, it says, very strange. All you have to do is go ask Don Young what school he taught in. He used to teach in the Bureau of Indian Affairs school building before they had the transition, you know.
Mm-hmm.
You know? If you don't believe him, you get out of the business, you know. But there was two schools here. One was Indian school, one was white school. You were considered white if you had quarter white in your blood or more. If you had no white, then you were considered an Indian. Sometimes they take the color of skin, too. Depends. And then they talk about fighting in the education system. That caused more problems than anything else. Yeah.
Did the schools have access to the same resources? Was one education or different than the other?
Completely different. The Bureau of Indian Affairs kind of taught you how to read and write in your ABC, and that they come to a stop where the state school had regular system like they have today. And the Bureau of Indian Affairs only went to 5th or 6th grade, I'm not sure. The highest grade they went. Then they shipped you off to, it's in Mount Edgecombe, it's Wrangell, I think, Wrangell Institute.
What grade did the territorial school go up to?
8th grade. Then someone started a couple of missionaries or somebody started a high school here. And went for a couple of years. They quit. I don't know why.
But were they Episcopal or another denomination?
Episcopal.
Do you remember when that was?
No, I don't. I'd probably be 5, 6, 7 years old. So that would put me in my 60s in a way. But it didn't last long. It was incidents that took place in the school. They used the hall, the man that built a show house here, and he let them play basketball. And one of the teachers would introduce basketball to the students, and they all had to have a gym suit. Well, my mother made my two sisters a gym suit, My brother says, the hell with it, he wouldn't wear it. And it was time to have the introduction publicly. They invited people come to see what this new sport was going to be. Oh, I think they got a laugh out of it and laughed themselves sick all the way home. Their parents wouldn't allow their children to be seen half naked out in this, playing this game. I remember my sister came home and she half cried and half laughed. It was so hilarious. Yeah, couldn't see running around half naked up in the court throwing a ball in a basket. So that never went over. The only sports that rose in Fort Yukon is baseball. They love to play baseball here. Well, I know you got 1,001 questions you want to ask. You don't know where to start.
I know. It's just great listening to you. You have so many fantastic memories. One question I had was how the town itself operated and was governed, and how that related to business. Did folks like your dad have to pay any money to be doing trading here in Fort Yukon, and to whom, or how did that work?
No, there's no taxation on any business. State had your taxation, but locally, nothing. It was governed by most of the curfew and stuff like that was governed by the Bureau of Indian Affairs people. They sent letter home and says that the curfew is these hours and nobody should be on the streets after certain hours. And, well, you know, nobody to enforce it, so they got together. I say they, so it's a community meeting, I should say. And they said, well, let's hire a truant officer, a policeman to do all this work and keep the kids off the streets to get to school on time and outdoors playing or sliding down the hill. Excellent idea. So they hired a guy in town here, and it was right up his alley. He loved the job. He got paid through donations. He had a couple extra cans of milk and a little extra meat. Something to give him. It wasn't a cash deal. He just wanted something, and it worked out very good. I got chased home a couple of times, I remember. But if you didn't do what he say, he'd take you by the neck and drag you home. Yeah, he took it to heart. Definitely, first truant officer we had.
who thought to hire the truant officer? Was it the people of Fort Yukon or the BIA?
BIA, because it came out of the school, see?
Mm-hmm.
Their school. Here I go again, in their school. Toward the end, it was a cooperative deal, and they paid poor Johnny a extra money, and he did other little chores, and finally it all worked out.
Wow.
They gave him extra money too. He used to be the runner for the magistrate. Someone was supposed to be in court at 10 o'clock to discuss his problems, and they're not there. I'll send Johnny after him, and Johnny would go drag him up and says, here, 10 o'clock, you're supposed to be near.
Was there any law enforcement back then?
We had a deputy marshal in the community. Yeah, he served the area. You see, we were still under federal law. A lot of people don't know it, but we just got out of the federal law, 49. I got appointed the United States Commissioner here and around that time. And we had only one law book that we all used, and it was getting pretty old. Things weren't in there that should have been, and things should have been taken out that were in there. Oh, statute was in sight, so they didn't bother trying to change anything. And statute came on a couple of years later, and I got appointed then as a magistrate under the new state system. I served in that capacity for 9 years. Yeah, that was interesting. You don't want to hear that.
Sure I do. You keep talking, I'll keep writing notes. I'll keep recording. Sounds like you had you saw Fort Yukon, you lived through a pretty interesting time.
Yeah, sometimes I wish I was 50 years older, and I'd have been right in the best part of the an establishment. You know, you're too young here and you're too old there. Go back 50 years, you'd sell more things and probably had more experiences.
When people were first, when white trappers and traders were first coming into the country?
Yeah.
There were a lot of men who had come from, like Ivor, who had come from Scandinavian
countries.
Where was your family from?
My dad is from Minnesota. They were Irish and German. My mom is originally from Canada and the Mackenzie country. She's an Athabascan Indian from over there. Her dad is one of those stubborn Englishmen that came over and went one way and didn't think nothing of it, you know. There were an English ship that went through here, traders, and they abandoned, what do they call it, mutiny? Mutinied the ship. They lived 2 years with the Eskimos and worked their way here. Now there's several people in the community that was from that ship. And they all married and spent the rest of their life here.
So did your mom grow up in the Mackenzie River country, or did she grow up more around Fort Yukon?
More or less around here. Yeah. She got married pretty young to my dad. I know, 15, 16 years of age, I guess.
How old would your dad have been?
What, 18? Just a young man. How old was dad when you got married, Eva?
I don't remember.
Probably don't want to.
Pretty young, I hear.
I hear.
Did you grow up speaking only English in your home, or did you grow up?
No, we spoke only English.
Mm-hmm. How about your mom?
She speaks both.
Mm-hmm. In the Mackenzie country, are they Gwich'in too?
Yes.
Did you guys eat?
Muktuk? No.
Well, did you eat a lot of subsistence native foods, or did you eat mostly canned?
We ate mostly subsistence food. Still do. Yeah. I mean, there's nothing. My next 5 meals away, if I can have a good rabbit dinner.
Mm-hmm. And your dad liked to eat?
No, he'd eat anything. I pulled a trick on him one time. It's really pike. Northern pike, big, they get. And my dad always says, you know, take the damn, they call them man-eaters out on them around. So my mother said we wanted it, and she'll fix it so he can eat it. And she, he breaded it and deep fried it, and he ate it, and he ate two plates of it, and he wanted to know where we got it. I told him where we sent to it from Fairbanks. But he says, next time you order me some too. He never did tell him. It was a pike, mother's black over it. I traveled one end of Alaska to the other. Very educational. Different people, different lifestyle.
Well, I would love to sit here and listen to your stories all day. Thank you so much for sharing your memories with me. It's been fascinating.